Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we evaluate the current state of youth representation in the California juvenile justice system. Nearly 50 years ago, a landmark Supreme Court case gave juveniles accused of crimes the same due process rights as adults. Despite this monumental decision, some minors in California courts have suffered due to lack of competent legal representation. Assembly Bill 703 seeks to address this issue by assuring defense attorneys receive the education and training required to effectively represent our young people. However, in spite of this progress, challenges remain, and we'll spend the next hour discussing many of the issues that juveniles continue to face in our courts. We'll ask, does the legal system view juveniles as less responsible for their actions than adults? And what is the goal of juvenile justice? To punish or rehabilitate? How is California improving youth access to quality legal representation and support programs? And finally, what is being done to address the challenges that our young defendants and their attorneys continue to deal with today? Joining me in the studio this evening to discuss these issues and more are Roger Chan. He is the co-founder and executive director of East Bay Children's Law Offices and a former public defender in San Francisco and Alameda counties. Roger is also an advisory board member of the Pacific Juvenile Defender Center and the Youth Justice Institute, and a member of the National Association for the Council of Children and the California Public Defenders Association. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And we're joined by phone by Sue Burrell. She is the Policy and Training Director of the Pacific Juvenile Defender Center. She's a former staff lawyer at the Youth Law Center, trial lawyer and juvenile appellate training specialist for the Los Angeles County Public Defender, and appellate lawyer for the California State Public Defender. Sue has also been the recipient of numerous honors and awards, including the American Bar Association's Livingston Hall Award in 2011, an award given to individuals who fiercely advocate for children and their interests. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you for inviting me.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, I wanted to start with you. Roger, how many youth are in custody in California at this moment?
Well, Sue's going to actually probably know the total number, but when you ask us about youth in custody, you have to remember that we have both state facilities as well as county facilities. Youth can be in custody either in their county juvenile hall or their county camps or ranches. And then there's a number of young people who are in state custody at the Division of Juvenile Justice. And Sue might know the number that we have in the state facilities right now, which has fortunately dramatically decreased over the last several years.
Sue, do you want to tell us what you think the numbers are?
In our state facilities, the Division of Juvenile Facilities, there are somewhere between 700 and 800 youth in there right now. But what a lot of people don't realize is that right now in California, we have more than 6,000 young people who are in state prison for offenses committed when they were under the age of 18. And then, as Roger said, there are another probably several thousand young people in county facilities, which could be either their juvenile halls or their ranches or camps.
So when you make that distinction, the 6,000 that are in state prison for crimes committed as minors, were they convicted or as adults? Are they tried as adults?
Or, yes.
Okay. So what happens to youth who are convicted and then become of age, so to speak, over the age of, 18, 24? What happens to them?
What happens is that there are three ways you can get to adult court. One is that the prosecutor directly files charges against you in adult court. So there's no hearing, there's no social study or anything. It's just the decision of the prosecutor. And that can be done as a result of Proposition 21, which was enacted in the year 2000. And it's now the subject of a ballot initiative where we're trying to undo that. The more traditional way you wind up in adult court is through what's called a fitness hearing, in which a petition is filed to find you incapable of being rehabilitated in the juvenile system. and there's a hearing in front of a judge, both sides can put on evidence about whether or not you could be rehabilitated, and there are specific criteria that have to be followed. And then a judge decides whether you go to adult court or not. But once one of those things happens, once there's either direct filing or a finding of unfitness in juvenile court, then you're tried just like an adult would be, and you can get every sentence an adult could get, up to and including life without the possibility of parole.
Okay, that helps give us a broad picture of the numbers and some of the issues of what happens to juveniles once they are arrested. And I wanted to go back, though, first to something that Roger Chan mentioned early on, which was saying that there is a decrease in the number of youth in custody, and its number has been falling. Why has that happened?
Well, there's a lot of different reasons for that, and I don't think we can point to any one factor. A lot of it is that statewide and nationwide arrests for crime are just generally going down. But I think also what we've seen over the last several years in juvenile court throughout different counties are just different, maybe more innovative approaches and looking at alternatives to detention, looking at different ways in which young people can be rehabilitated, can be given services, and to have that done in the community, where at the same time the court is balancing the protection of community of the community, of public safety. And so I think there's just been different approaches that include anything from electronic monitoring to wraparound services, where young people are just getting a lot of support in their homes to strengthen their families, strengthen their communities, help them get back on track with their education.
Sue, what would you add to that in terms of reasons for this trend and decreased traditional incarceration of youth in this state?
Well, I agree with Roger that nobody really knows, but what we've seen is that there was a spike in juvenile and adult crime, for that matter, in the 1980s and into the, like, up till the mid-90s. But since that time, crime has just gone steadily down, and particularly in the juvenile system. And so we're seeing only a fraction of the number of petitions filed against young people in the system now. And as a result of that, fewer of them are detained. Although I do have to say, California still has the fifth highest rate nationally, the rate of detention. So we still detain a larger proportion of the young people who are arrested.
And not to be forgotten when we talk about incarceration or detention rates is that for both adult and juveniles, there's a disproportionate impact on communities of color, young people of color, in particularly African-American young men, tend to be detained at higher rates than others.
This kind of mirrors some of the media out there about sort of harsher punishment in schools too, right, of children of color. So it seems like that sort of that school-to-prison pipeline that is often talked about is – you can see it in what you're seeing as a defender of youth.
That's exactly right, yes. And one thing that has been very promising over the last couple of years is the way that – schools, as well as the juvenile court system, has come to understand trauma as a significant contributor to some of the issues and behaviors that we see. And so a number of school districts have taken what they call a trauma-informed approach to dealing with what historically has been treated as school discipline issues. And those are the willful defiance problems, the behaviors that that lead to young people getting suspended and then ultimately getting pushed out of their schools. Schools are taking a new approach and looking at that and saying, hey, you know what? Our young people live in difficult communities, have experienced a number of very traumatic events in their communities, and that this all has an impact on the behaviors that we see in school. And so I think that's an important – this idea of thinking about trauma and the role that it plays in the lives of the young people is also a really important development in juvenile court as well.
meaning it leads to less people who get arrested because somehow someone upstream took a different approach? Or are you saying that trauma-informed approaches are also coming into the juvenile court system? Or both?
Both. Many juvenile courts are taking a trauma-informed approach, but it is definitely affecting the upstream in terms of that school-to-prison pipeline that you referenced, that a number of young people who might have been suspended and then expelled and also prosecuted are not ending up in juvenile court anymore, and instead schools as well as the juvenile court system are developing trauma-informed or trauma-based responses and giving young people more appropriate services that get to the underlying problems. And it's also a different way of understanding the behaviors, not to excuse or overlook or say that young people shouldn't have consequences for behaviors, but it's understanding, or it's a different approach to treating the behavior and not necessarily criminalizing every conduct that we see.
And Sue,
Roger and I have a part in changing a long-standing practice in California, which was that if you were truant from school, you could be locked up in juvenile hall. If the judge said you must go to school and you still didn't go to school, you could be locked up for what was called contempt of court. And Roger and I helped to draft and get through the legislature a bill that changed that practice a couple of years ago. And so now if you're truant from school and the judge tells you to go to school and it still doesn't take, other kinds of interventions are utilized.
So let's get back to the what happens to juveniles once they are arrested. We've talked a little bit about the upstream interventions that are maybe bending the curve, so to speak, and perhaps some other things that are in the works. But tell us what happens to a juvenile once they are arrested. Walk us through that, because my sense is that it's perhaps a little different than what happens to adults or could happen to adults. Am I right there, Roger?
Well, it's similar. What happens if a young person is arrested and brought to the juvenile hall, the first person that is looking at the case is a probation officer, the juvenile probation officer, who has to decide whether or not to refer the case to the district attorney for prosecution. The really important factor at this point is that because it's a young person, but this is also similar for adults, the district attorney only has a very short amount of time to make a decision as to whether or not to file charges in the case. If the young person's been arrested and is at juvenile hall, then the decision has to be made within 2 business days, 48 hours. If charges are filed, then the young person comes to court, and the court has to consider whether or not the young person can be maintained safely in the community pending the outcome of the case. And then, similar to the adult system, young people, and this wasn't always true, but this is kind of tied into our nearly 50 years after In re Galt, is that young people are presumed to be innocent, just as adults would. Young people are provided the same due process rights. They do have a right to have a trial. They have a right to have a lawyer represent them. They have a right to confront the evidence that's brought in against them. They have a right to present their own case, and they have a right to remain silent, just as adults do. Really important difference, though, between the juvenile court system and the adult court system is that there's no right to a jury trial. In a juvenile case, it's the judge who will listen to the evidence and decide whether or not there's enough evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to find that the young person did what they were alleged to have done.
And Sue, what is your take on that initial phase there? Any other differences or similarities or similarities that perhaps should be differences between youth and how youth are treated and how adults are treated in that beginning phase immediately post-arrest?
Well, originally, juvenile court was supposed to be confidential. The idea was that you're a young person. You may have made a mistake, done something wrong, but the idea was that juvenile court would intervene in dealing with whatever your issues or your behavior was, but then would try not to interfere with your ability to move forward in your life. And one thing that has changed over time, not in a good direction, in my opinion, is that those protections for confidentiality have been substantially eroded over time. And so there's a whole list of of charges, that if you are charged with those offenses, the public is admitted into the court proceedings, and your record can't be sealed. So that's an issue we're grappling with right now. The balance seems to be tipping back a little bit more toward confidentiality, but we have a long way to go with restoring that to juvenile justice.
And we find ourselves in also an unusual situation in juvenile court, because while much of juvenile court is about protecting a young person's confidentiality and this idea that we're going to focus on rehabilitation, so for example, not having the right to a jury trial is somewhat of a lessened protection. Increasingly, young people have been exposed to adult consequences. So for example, a juvenile adjudication, even though the young person didn't have a jury decide guilt or innocence, a juvenile case can be counted as a strike under California three strikes law and follow that young person for the rest of his or her life. So things have progressed in a way where young people have faced increasingly serious consequences without necessarily receiving the same amount of due process protections related to that.
So building on that, this being some 50 years or so almost, it will be next year, 1967 was the decision in Ray Gault that allowed or made mandatory the due process provisions for juveniles as well. What has remained in your minds, both of you, some ongoing gaps, either in what that Supreme Court decision covered or in the enforcement of those rights over time?
Well, one of the most fundamental things that the In re Gault case did that's still true and still very important is it also made clear that for a youth, when they're arrested, their parents need to be notified about where they are. And so that's one really important part of juvenile court that sometimes gets taken for granted. But a young person can't just be arrested in the streets and taken to juvenile hall without telling their parents, here's where your child is. And you can only imagine in Jerry Gault's case how crazy his mom went, because she didn't know where he had been taken. But I think when we look at the due process rights that In re Gault said, and In re Gault said that youth should have the same protections in when they're accused of crimes as adults would, one of the areas that we really looked at, and this was part of AB 703, was how to make sure these due process rights are meaningful, and starting with the right to counsel. Because one thing that must be acknowledged is that working with a youth is very different than working with an adult, and that juvenile court and juvenile law is a specialized area of law. And so it's important that attorneys, even if they're the best criminal defense attorney in the state, they still need to know the particularities related to juvenile court and how to use juvenile law to ensure that young people get appropriate dispositions and rehabilitation services. And another growing understanding in juvenile court is how important what we call the post-dispositional phase is, that even after a young person has been given the adult equivalent of conviction and sentencing, the case doesn't end, because the young person is now has now been given probation conditions or has been given certain programs that he or she must complete in order to have their case dismissed. And this post-disposition phase, this time period in which a young person is to complete services and meet certain goals, is a really critical stage for youth, because we need to make sure that they're getting appropriate supports and services, and that that they're able to stay on track, and that they're and that juvenile court is providing them with the rehabilitation services that they need.
So, Sue Burrell, what do you think of the quality, I should say, of the representation that youth are receiving? And I imagine, given that you and Roger were co-sponsors of AB 703, you had some concerns about that.
Yes. Well, what happened was that we, several years ago, the Pacific Juvenile Defender Center surveyed lawyers who represent young people at several conferences around the state, and we surveyed them about what training they had when they began representing young people, and what they wished they had had in terms of training. And what we found out was that half the lawyers we surveyed in California began representing young people in juvenile court with zero juvenile-specific training. And so we realized that there was quite a void with respect to who is representing young people, even though they may have worked very hard and so on. So that was one thing we wanted to cover in AB 703. Another thing is that we have been concerned over time, and this is, of course, related to resources, but we're very concerned that that lawyers do not always fully investigate the case, that they do not engage other kinds of experts like social workers, educational experts, mental health experts, to help them develop the case. Because really, you shouldn't be going into court until you know everything there is to know about the young person and everything there is to know about the alleged offense, so that you can really develop a theory of the case and a theory of what you think ought to happen.
So why are attorneys less likely to be comprehensive in their approach?
Some of it has to do with training, of just really, as Roger said, not having a full understanding of what their role is as counsel for a young person. And some of it has to do with resources. There's a big to-do going on in Los Angeles right now, because it turns out that the lawyers who are on an appointment panel, not the public defender, but the other lawyers who are appointed when there are conflicts of interest, that they've been getting between $340 and $360 per case, no matter whether it's a murder or
not per hour. We're not talking the billable hours movement here.
No,
okay.
No. I mean,
wow,
no one could competently, no matter how good a lawyer you were, you couldn't competently represent somebody for that amount of money.
And it does, do we see this same gap when we talk about private attorneys that are pulled in to represent adults?
I think less so, because there. I mean, for one thing, it's different in every county. Every county handles its appointments in a different way, and I think more of the adult appointed counsel are a lot of times they work for a bar association project, and they typically are reimbursed by the hour. But that isn't that very often is not the case in juvenile court. It isn't true for adults. In some counties, they have contract offices that say, we'll take all the cases for the next year and we'll do it for this low price for you. And so you kind of get what you pay for.
But basically what you've just described is that the attorneys who are interested in doing this work get less training than they think they should be getting.
Yeah.
They get very little pay for taking these cases on, especially in the case of the private attorneys.
Yes.
So, of course, that begs the question, sort of, what are the consequences of these two factors? But I'm going to hold you there to reintroduce the program first. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're discussing the current state of youth representation in the California juvenile justice system with our guests Roger Chan, co-founder and executive director of East Bay Children's Law Offices, and Sue Burrell, policy and training director for the Pacific Juvenile Defender Center. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. Have you or a family member been in the juvenile justice system? What was your experience in the California juvenile court system? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So Roger, I want to turn that question to you. When you have lawyers that are undertrained and underpaid to represent juveniles when the public defenders are not available or there's a conflict of interest, as Sue mentioned, what happens?
Well, the real danger is that you will end up with young people who have been wrongfully convicted for something they didn't do, or who spend excessive or unnecessary periods of time in incarceration. And even more than that, the juvenile court makes sometimes some really profound, life-changing decisions for a young person that isn't quite the same as an adult court, because the juvenile court's special role in terms of looking out for the best interests of a youth can extend to making decisions about where the young person lives, where the young person goes to school, what connections the young person has. In one case, I was just talking to a young person earlier today who had been involved in the juvenile court system. And a decision by the judge about where she was to live really ended up changing the course of her life, because she was a former foster youth and she had an opportunity to be adopted. And because she found herself in trouble and was in a juvenile court system, she lost that opportunity to be adopted when she was younger. And that doesn't happen for everyone, of course, but that's the extent to which a juvenile court can make some really impactful decisions on the overall direction of a young person's life. And that's where, if the young person's attorney doesn't really know their client and understand not just what happened, why the young person was arrested, but really understand the social history and dynamic and be engaged on that level, that really life-changing decisions can be made. And I don't think that can be underestimated. And that's kind of one of the reasons why we thought AB 703 was so important, is that we want to push back on the notion that it's just juvenile court, that that it's not as serious or not as significant as other types of cases. And I think sometimes that's part of the cultural value that does need to be pushed back, because when people think about our community's youth, everyone says, I get it. They're really important. We really want to do right by them. And then when we look at the investment into the services and resources available to them, sometimes it doesn't match. But but these consequences can change the direction of a young person's life, for better or worse.
Sue, did you want to add to that?
Well, yeah, I think that what Roger said is just so true. And I feel like, obviously, if you have a well-equipped, well-trained lawyer who does a full investigation, first of all, you will be able to do away with wrongful conviction and make sure that motions that should be brought are brought, for example, to suppress illegally seized evidence or confessions.
You're saying something very quickly there that I'm sure means you guys understand, but maybe a lot of people don't understand on the radio, including myself here, which you're saying there's different types of admissibility of evidence in
yes.
youth. Okay. And other types of procedural things that you can do or can't do in
yes.
the youth court. So you need to know those things.
You have to know those things. Mm-hmm. But even more than that, even if the court properly finds that you did what you were supposed to have done, there is an opportunity for the court to make orders that will get services for the young person that will address whatever their issues are. We find so often that there are young people who have learning disabilities. Sometimes there are youth with unrecognized mental health issues. Sometimes there are youth, as Roger mentioned, that have experienced trauma. And those are all things that can be and should be addressed. And if you don't have a lawyer who has really talked to the young person, really understands what's going on, those opportunities are missed to address the issues. And then, of course, it's much more likely that the young person will come back into the system in the future.
Going back to that idea of the upstream effects or the upstream decisions that were made by adults, whether in the schools or other places, I wonder, is there reform in bringing these these juveniles to trial at all that you're advocating for? It seems like there's a lot of social factors here that could really benefit from a different approach than bringing people to a courtroom.
Actually, we are engaged in that kind of a legislative discussion right now. There's a bill in the legislature that deals with young people who are incompetent to stand trial. And that means that they are so impaired mentally that they're either because of a developmental disability, an intellectual challenge or mental illness, or maybe just because they're very young. And we are trying very hard to get a diversion option into that bill in the legislature. It's because what you're saying is very well established, that juvenile justice all too often becomes the default placement when families and other people in the community are not able to access services in the community, which is really the right place for them to be provided.
A criticism of the adult system as well.
Yes.
Yes. Roger?
Well, one of the most important aspects of juvenile court is the opportunity for a diversion. And going back to how a case begins and the probation officer being the first person that the young person sees, the probation officer is also making a decision about whether or not the behavior can be resolved informally. Can the parents deal with the situation, or does it need to be elevated to a prosecution, to a formal court process? And that opportunity to use diversion, to use community-based resources, to build on family strengths is a really critical part of juvenile court that can do exactly as you say. It can allow young people to be held accountable, to receive help and support without it going to court, without having to go through the whole trial process.
Let me reintroduce the program again. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the current state of youth representation in the California juvenile justice system with our guests here in studio, Roger Chan, co-founder and executive director of East Bay Children's Law Offices, and by phone, Sue Burrell, policy and training director for the Pacific Juvenile Defender Center. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Do you work with youth in schools or in other places? What do you think about what you're hearing tonight about needed reforms to the juvenile justice system? Are you a parent? What do you think should our system change to become over time? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Let's go to an email from Sarah in Oakland. Sarah states, how is the state of California addressing inequities in the distribution of its adolescent social services. Why are some counties receiving more robust services than others? Are these services and or the funding distributed to the regions that need it the most? Sue, did you want to start with that?
I think I'll turn that one over to Roger.
Okay, Roger, go ahead.
Well, I think one of the I think the question is terrific because it addresses something that we see in real life on a day-by-day basis, which is that the available services are not the same county to county. And part of the answer to the question is that each county has to decide how to allocate their resources and how to budget and how to prioritize certain youth programs. So some counties have invested in all types of programs at the very front end that are designed to keep young people out of further trouble. In San Francisco, for example, we have something called the CARC, which is the first stop generally for a young person when they have a police contact, and they get assessed and they get matched to services. And oftentimes that level of intervention prevents the need to escalate to even probation, much less going all the way through the court process. Other counties don't have that kind of programs. We see the same sort of inequities in mental health services, for example. So I think the question touches on a very important point, which is that young people should have access to services, access to justice, access to opportunity, no matter where they live and what side of the county border they live on. And the solutions really lay in individual counties and the priorities that they make.
And so is there anything being done at the state level to kind of level these gaps or fill in these gaps, I should say, in those counties that don't have as much robust resources?
The trend in terms of the funding mechanism, the state's been moving towards what we call realignment, which is shifting funding and responsibility to counties. And there's very good reasons for that, which are to allow for more localized responses, to make decisions that reflect the priorities and values of individual communities rather than having a one-size-fits-all approach through the state. So that's been kind of the movement of the funding that leads to counties having different access to services. Similarly, in the schools, there's been an effort to move to more local control. So I guess the solution has to be on the county level, and people who are interested and who care need to make their voices heard with their local government to say, why don't we have more of this? Why don't we have more services to help young people in these areas?
Let's go to a caller. We have Rebecca from Oakland. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Rebecca Young. So hi, Roger, and hi, Sue. I honor and respect the tremendous work you both have done. I'm calling in basically to offer a comment, which is I would love to hear each of you discuss the research into brain development that has been done over the last 10 to 12 years, which is significantly impacting United States Supreme Court decisions regarding juvenile justice, and that a lot of people I don't think know about, and it would be great for the listeners to hear that there's now established science out there about the teenage brain and how the CEO of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, is not fully developed, particularly in males, until almost age 25. And that the information that has been generated as a result of this brain science research has actually caused the United States Supreme Court to end death penalty for juveniles, to end mandatory life without parole, and mandatory life sentences. I don't think a lot of people know that the teenage brain is really immature and undeveloped and incapable of contemplating consequences, weighing, you know, the pros and cons and all that. And also, if you could discuss what plans there are for training judges and prosecutors and probation officers who hold so much power over these children's lives, into helping them understand the science.
Thank you so much, Rebecca, for your comments. I'm going to let Sue start there. Sue, what would you like to add from Rebecca's pretty expansive comments there?
Excellent points, Rebecca, and you're right on. What's happened over the last 10 years is that the United States Supreme Court has had five different juvenile decisions that talk about adolescent development and brain science. And this really isn't an accident, because behind the scenes, over the last 20 years, there has been more and more funding to study adolescent development and brain science, particularly by the MacArthur Foundation. And what has come forth is the idea that juveniles lack maturity. They have an underdeveloped sense of responsibility, and they act impulsively. They don't think about the future. Something that all of us know, if we know any teenagers or we can remember how we were at that age. Also, they're vulnerable to negative influences, particularly negative peer pressure, but also from older adults. And since they don't control their environment usually, it's hard for them to escape those kinds of negative influences. And then most importantly, what this research has found, as Rebecca pointed out, is that that their personality traits change over time. Only a small number of young people who get in trouble when they're younger go on to be adult criminals. Most people age out of whatever they're doing that gets them into trouble by the time they're in their early to mid-20s. And so all of this is just so important for us to know in the juvenile justice system or in the criminal justice system if we're trying young people as adults, because what the Supreme Court has come to say is that we can't treat young people the same as we do mature adults in terms of the sentencing that we impose on them. And that's why it's unfair to impose the death penalty on them or life without parole in certain kinds of cases. And we've actually had some of these cases in California over the last few years that embody these principles. But I think that it's sort of unusual. Usually you would start with less serious cases and work your way up to more serious cases that embody these principles. But in this case, it's coming from very serious cases in the Supreme Court. And I think what we're going to see in our juvenile justice system is more application of the principles of adolescent development to everyday cases that we see in juvenile court. At least I hope so.
And so to the second part of that question, Roger, what is AB 703 looking to do in terms of bringing that science and bringing that knowledge to bear within the courts, whether it's the attorneys, the prosecutors, the probation officers, the judges?
The brain science is so important because we now have scientific research to tell us what anyone who's ever dealt with a teenager already knows, which is that youth matters. Young people youth are different than adults. And so the question now is, you know, and is really perhaps oversimplifying, but really boiling down the brain science to understanding that because decision-making for youth and their the part of their brain that controls impulsivity is not fully developed, and that youth are still developing and are able to change and are more so than adults, because the science confirms what we all know about young people, the question really is, so what must be our response? If we know this and this is scientifically proven to be true, how do we as a society and we as a system respond to scientific fact? AB 703 was really just the first step, and AB 703 focused on the role of the juvenile defense attorney, in part because the defense attorney has such a special relationship with the young person as a client and is in such close proximity to the youth and as the young person's advocate, as the young person's voice, is really the defense. And similar measures have not yet been taken in terms of requiring training for judges and training for probation officers and training for district attorneys. Although that being said, these other professionals who work with young people have, I'm sure, their own training related to understanding adolescent development and how that should impact the way they and their jobs interact with the youth. But
do you see it the same way, Sue? Do you see that the others in the room besides the defense attorney are ahead of the game in terms of understanding this brain science of adolescence? Because, of course, my concern, of course, would be the defense attorneys start to learn this and then no one else in the room knows what they're talking about.
Well, right. I think that it's a process. And I think that I know that at our statewide judges conference, there have been sessions the last couple of years on these issues that judges and probation officers attend. But overall, I still think there is a disconnect in terms of the kinds of dispositions and sentencing that we do for juveniles, because we're still so focused on incarceration, on that somehow if you put somebody somewhere for a certain amount of time, that's going to fix things. And, of course, all of this research that we've been talking about also tells us what really does work, and it isn't incarceration. Everything that involves incarceration makes it more difficult to do the things that young people need.
And why is that, and what does work?
Okay, so what does work, and this is from the National Academies of Science.
First, why does incarceration not work?
Well, it in a way, it interferes with your ability to do the things you need to do to move on in your life. School is, even though there's school in custody, it's never as good as it would be on the outside. You have no ability to have normal social relationships. Particularly with other kids who are not in trouble. You have no ability to exercise judgment or skills or even to really pursue academic pursuits in the way you could in the community. And so all of this sets you back even more than you already would have been. Because what we want for the young people in juvenile justice is the same thing we want for our own children. We want them to learn through a process of being supported by adults who care about them, preferably their parents, but by any caring adult, that they can learn how to exercise good judgment and make good decisions in their lives, and also not just focus on what they did wrong. It's so negative what we do to them, of like reminding them 90 million times a day that they did something bad, instead of building on their strengths.
So I interrupted you when you were going to say what the science shows what works.
Well, the National Academy of Sciences, the three elements on what's needed for healthy development are, number one, the presence of a parent or parent figure that's involved with the young person and concerned about them. And then number two, association with peers who value and model positive social behavior and academic success. And then third, I did mention this already, they need to be involved in activities that require them to make autonomous decisions and to develop critical thinking. So it's things like extracurricular activities, sports, art.
How do you build that in as you're also trying to build in consequences?
I think you can do it. You know, they all know they did something wrong, but I think you can't load them up so much that they with negative messages to them that they lose hope and that they really sort of give up. And it's true. I think some young people are going to be out of the community for some period, and I think that a lot more could be done when they're in out of home settings to incorporate these elements of what's needed for healthy development. We just really aren't even scratching the surface of what we could do with that. And then, of course, to the extent that we can keep them in the community with supports and supports for their parents, that's so much to the better.
Just want to put that phone number out there again if you want to join us here on City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org as we discuss California's juvenile justice system and the current state of youth representation there with our guests Roger Chan and Sue Burrell. You can dial 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. Email us at cityvisions@klw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website or tweet us at cityvisionsklw. So, Roger, I wanted to pose this email from Thomas in San Francisco to you. What can we do if a family member is currently incarcerated and we believe that they did not receive the representation they deserved or needed?
Well, I'm sorry to hear about that kind of situation. And in terms of legal solutions, often the opportunity is to have filed a notice of appeal if the person feels like there was a problem in their trial process. But there's a deadline to that in which that notice of appeal has to be filed.
And what is that deadline?
is 60 days from the sentencing date or the disposition date in juvenile court. And so there are other remedies such as contacting the California State Bar or the local bar association or the management of the law firm that represented the person. And I think what's really important is that for the young person or for the family members who are going through the process and they're concerned that it's not proceeding as they hoped or that things are missing, to not wait until it's too late to raise an issue. And oftentimes you can ask a question to the attorney and get your question resolved, because sometimes what is being perceived as a concern actually has a very simple explanation that that can satisfy the family or the person standing trial.
So state bar, local bar association, or the manager of the office that the attorney comes from. What if it's past that 60 days?
Unfortunately, in terms of a legal remedy, there's no. If the time frame to file the notice of appeal has passed, then they lose the opportunity to challenge what the conviction, if that's what the concern was. Now, in juvenile court, as I said earlier, the case doesn't end at the disposition or at the sentencing. The case continues on, and the young person continues to have a right to legal representation. And so I would encourage the family members or the young person to have that conversation with the lawyer, to express their concerns, to see if they can resolve the issue. And ultimately, if they're not able to, then the problem can be brought up to the judge.
And ask for a new representation?
Yes, and that's done in private. The judge conducts a private hearing to hear what the complaint is about. And that's sort of how AB 703 is set up in terms of how will there be accountability to the lawyers to meet their training and minimum standards. And that responsibility will be on the juvenile court judge to ensure that lawyers have satisfied the required state standards.
So, Sue, I wanted to we're in the last 6 or 7 minutes of the program. I wanted to get from you, what are the next steps for determining what exactly this training is going to look like? How long is it going to take? Do you imagine that this new training requirement may turn people off to wanting to represent juveniles because it's more work and more training for perhaps the same amount of pay?
Okay, well, two parts to answer this. We will know very soon, because the California Judicial Council is voting this month in April.
It was actually last Friday. This past Friday.
So do we know?
I believe it was approved.
Okay, go ahead.
So they
what did they approve?
A rule that has what the training is, what the subjects are that people need to be trained on, how many hours they need initially, and then on an ongoing basis every year to get. But I actually think, from my experience in talking to people so far, that the lawyers are very excited about this. And when we did our surveys a few years ago, the lawyers really wanted training. They really wanted to know what they should be doing. They wanted adolescent development. They wanted to know about mental health issues. They wanted to know about education and immigration, and all of those things are going to be in the court rule that will take effect July 1st. So I think this is just a complete win-win for everybody. I haven't heard anybody grumbling about it.
So I can see a lawyer who then now gets this extra training is compelled by what they learn to really dig deeper and have a much larger collateral network of information to build the case, but then is still faced with the compensation gap. Any work on that?
Well, the big issue right now is in Los Angeles, which has close to half of the young people in the juvenile justice system in the state, and it's pretty clear that the Board of Supervisors is taking it to heart, and that they're going to come up with a system that more fairly compensates lawyers and gives them access to investigators and social workers and other experts that they need. But unfortunately, Los Angeles aside, it's a county by county issue, and so every county has its own set of circumstances. I know a few years ago, San Francisco, even though they have a very good program, they were going to defund the social workers in the public defender's office. And it was just so silly because the social workers are really actually very cost effective. And so we did advocacy to point that out to the supervisors, and we wound up prevailing on that. And I think we're just going to have a lot of individual county fights about whatever the particular circumstances are.
And Roger, to something you said very early on in the program, where you said, you know, that youth of color are disproportionately represented within the juvenile justice system in California. Any parts of this training that are going to include addressing some of the concerns around institutional racism or implicit bias in our justice system?
So all lawyers are required to meet minimum ongoing training requirements every 3 years. That includes an elimination of bias component. And in AB 703, dealing with implicit bias was certainly one of the required training areas that is critical for anyone working in the juvenile justice or criminal justice system. So yes, that's a part of it. And ultimately, this is all about the youth, and it's about ensuring that the youth is experiencing a justice system that is fair, and that they perceive the system as being fair, and that they perceive that their rights are meaningful, and that they understand their rights. And that's sort of ultimately the intent of AB 703, that young people feel like they were provided with their day in court, that their voice was heard and valued, and that they had input into what's happening in their life.
And Sue, Roger just mentioned perceptions there. How will we actually measure success or a successful impact of AB 703? How would you measure it? What are you going to be looking for? And in what time frame could we see those successes happen?
Oh, gosh. I do not know how we will measure success. I hope we will see fewer cases coming to our attention where someone was represented and a lawyer totally missed the boat on what was going on with the young person. Hopefully we'll see better appellate records where issues were raised in the way they should have been raised for appellate review. I think the hard part of this issue is that there's so much when there's incompetent representation, you really don't know what might have been. And so hopefully this training will help us to just see fewer of those sort of anecdotal errors that are so troubling when we see them now.
Any last words there, Roger, to round us out here?
Well, I'm excited. I think that AB 703 is a statement about the importance of young people and the importance of the juvenile court, and that attorneys who represent young people in juvenile court should have the resources and skills and training that they need to ultimately defend youth in the best way possible. So I think the new rule goes into effect on July 1st, and I hope that as a result of it, we see young people who are experiencing better outcomes all the way around.
And we'll have to stop it there. That's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Roger Chan, co-founder and executive director of East Bay Children's Law Offices, and Sue Burrell, policy and training director for the Pacific Juvenile Defender Center. Thanks to the two of you for joining me this evening.
My pleasure. Thank you for having
me.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulip. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Please join me next Monday in a conversation with former chairman of the FDA, Dr. David Kessler. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.